From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are lots of reasons people over the years have invented their own language. And this avocation goes back a long way. The linguist Erica Okrent says over the last 900 years, we have something like 900 invented languages. At times, it was an effort to fix the language they had, to re-engineer it. Sometimes it was to fix society, to create a language that was peaceful and universal. Today's version is a little different. There's a pretty vibrant community of people who have created their own languages, and Okrent says most of them don't see language as an enemy to be tamed or reformed. They see language as a muse. So their own languages are deeply personal expressions of creativity. Today in the program, we're talking about all of this, a story of how we think about language. After the news. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio inviting you to join us at Abravanel Hall the evening of September 24th for a conversation with Michael Lewis, one of the best nonfiction writers ever. And it's easy to make that case. I'll just mention the titles of some of his books: Moneyball, The Blind Side, The Big Short. This is not a radio program. The Hinckley Institute of Politics is bringing Lewis here at the end of the month, and he's joining me on stage. So we hope you'll be with us September 24th. For details, go to radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about constructed languages. That is, languages that people have created themselves, sort of like an invention. Among our guests today is the linguist Erica Okrent, who says there are something like 900 of these inventions created over the stretch of about 900 years. And frankly, most of them have failed. And the reason they haven't worked over time, Okrent says, tells us something about language, the languages we all speak. A lot of the early attempts at this were about fixing language, but Okrent says languages refuse to be cured. Real languages are organic and they're full of flaws, but those flaws are an important way that language actually takes hold. So it turns out it's incredibly difficult to invent a successful language. It's not really how it works. But, of course, there's a vibrant community of those who have created their own languages, not to fix one, but as an art form in many ways. So we're talking about all of this today, and we invite you to join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Erica Okrent is with us first, a linguist, a language editor at Mental Floss. It's a magazine of facts and trivia. She has a book called In the Land of Invented Languages, Adventures in Linguistic Creativity, Madness, and Genius. She's joining us today from Chicago Public Radio. And Erica Okrent, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I guess the obvious question is, you're a linguist, so I think a lot of people think that makes sense for you to look at constructed languages as a linguist. But you say in your book that a lot of linguists are not actually crazy about these constructed languages. Would you talk a little bit about what made you interested in it, and what is that relationship between linguists and constructed language?
Well, the point of linguistics as a science is to look at language as a natural object for observation. It's out there in the world. We want to find out how it works, what it says about the human mind, what its principles, what its rules are from looking at how it's used. And for someone to invent a language that's not really going to offer us the kind of data we need. How do people in nature, out there in the wild, use language? If you build this artificial thing, then if we look at that, we're not really looking at the natural capacity for language. All the languages linguists generally look at have evolved organically, naturally, out of our natural proclivities, and we want to that's what the program of linguistics is about, figuring the nature of language. Yeah. So artificial languages, they don't carry the same kind of interest. But I got interested in it in the perspective of for fun initially. I was looking through the library at all these books that seemed ridiculous to me, these little pamphlets that said, I have invented the world's most logical, perfect language, and I've laid out my philosophy for you. And I thought, oh, come on, what is this? But I got sucked in reading about the languages and the projects behind them, and then reading about the people who believed in these projects. What were they about? What were they trying to accomplish? And got drawn into the history of invented languages that way.
Yeah. And you really jumped in. I mean, you started, you know, you started going through the books and tried to learn some of these languages. So let's talk a little bit about sort of the history of all of this, because you write about this in your book. You say the history of language is a story about the way we think about language. Where do these constructed languages fit in that bigger story, do you think?
Well, in each era of language invention, and I do sort of separate them into general eras, because you can see the preoccupations of the time expressed in the kind of languages people were trying to invent. So those eras show you what were people troubled about with language? What were they trying to fix about language? What did they think language was for? And how did they want to address that with some kind of man-made creation having to do with language? So I think you get a picture looking at the history of what they came up with, of what people were fretting about in language, what they were concerned about, and how they were trying to address those concerns.
So interesting how contextual it is that the creation of a language was about, as you say, what they were worried about. And sometimes it was because they were worried about this language that they were using and that they thought was flawed and engineered improperly, and so they tried to fix it. But a lot of it was also about the war. They were worried about war. They were worried about poverty, and they thought there was some way to kind of reshape or fix society. It's all about, I guess, the context of the time.
Yeah, you can look at the world and say, you know, the reason we have these problems is partially because of language. That issue comes up again and again. People don't understand each other. People can't get along. Maybe it's because of language, or people can't tell when someone's telling them the truth. Maybe it's because of language and the sloppy imprecision of language. So what can we do about this? We can invent all kinds of things. Look at our ingenuity. Look at the growth of science. Well, let's tackle this next problem and see if we can do any better with language.
And they generally don't work. I mean, it just doesn't work that way. And what is it that you think tells us about language in terms of the fact that, yeah, they're not engineered very well. They're organic. They're alive. That's not quite how it works. So trying to fix it, trying to create it outside of an organic environment is just not going to happen.
Well, people think of language as a sort of a product or there's a marketplace of language, and we are all customers, and we choose which one we like, and we want to pick the best one, right? Why wouldn't we? So if we build the best one, then the people will come to it because it'll be clear, this is the thing we should use. But that's not really how it works with language. We don't say, you know, I'm going to build a better washing machine and everyone will want to buy my washing machine. You don't build a better language and have everyone say, oh, yes, clearly that works better. I'm going to go use that one. It's building a language, making one, is a much different thing than convincing people to use it. And that's where the failure comes in. You can build a perfect language, but if nobody comes, then it's not a language. If nobody's speaking it, you don't really have a language.
It's like Esperanto, you know, had such high hopes. And there are people who speak it, of course. Is that the most successful of constructed languages over time, even though that pretty much has fallen short too?
Well, with regard to the history of invented languages, it's wildly successful.
Yeah.
It's the most successful of all time because it is alive. People speak it. There are thousands of people who use it. There are people who use it in their families, and their children speak it as a first language. And that's rather amazing to go from one person with a pen and a notepad writing out their system to thousands of people actually living in this language. And that's a very rare kind of occurrence. But it did not become a universal language by any means, yeah, which was sort of the initial idea.
The first invented language that we know of, you write about in the book, was invented by a 12th century German nun.
Hildegard of Bingen.
Yeah, and she given to spiritual visions. Talk a little bit about that. Some say it was just her sort of writing down these, it was kind of a written down version of speaking in tongues, like kind of a lot of nonsense. But you say there was kind of more to it than that, I guess.
Yeah, it doesn't look like it's very deliberate. It's not sort of pages and pages of random repetition and syllables. It's lists of vocabulary, but the vocabulary lists aren't just about holy things or things of the spiritual realm. She has a word for saucepan and earwax and, you know, just a bunch of daily things that her and her nuns might have used to as a sort of secret language to refer to things, or it might have just been a creative project. She was painting music. She did it all, and this might have been just another form of sort of creative expression. But it's very deliberate, and it's not just about the spiritual matters. It's a very down to earth kind of vocabulary.
What happened to it?
Well, it was no one knows exactly what it was used for, but it was, that's our first surviving document of an invented language that we have. So we know it's been going on since the 12th century at least, though I suspect it's been going on much longer than that.
Yeah. This was, creating languages was a kind of a fad in the 17th century. I want to ask about this era of time. And let's talk about one inventor, creator, John Wilkins, because this gets at something you really explore in the book, and that is this relationship, the relationship of concepts to words. Talk about John Wilkins, if you would.
He was part of the science scene of the day. There were so many discoveries being made at this time. The scientific revolution, calculus was coming into being, mathematical notation was coming into being, and it was all these innovations that made it seem like if you could systematize and figure out what the perfect system was, you could make great advances in understanding the truth of things, the truths of mathematics, the truths of the universe. So why not do this for language? If we had a language that expressed concepts perfectly, you couldn't deceive with it. You couldn't use it to manipulate. When you spoke a word, the form of the word itself would tell you exactly what it meant. Mm. And where it was placed in the grand design of things, in the scheme of the universe, and our communication then would be perfect, our communication problem would be solved, and not only that, working things out in this language would force you to stick to the truths of the universe. So this was a very ambitious project. Lots of people made an attempt at this kind of thing before Wilkins did. But his was by far the most worked out. It was 600 pages where he gave everything in the universe its place, where it was in the hierarchy of concepts, of ideas. And then it burned up in the fire of London, and he did it all over again.
And you worked through it, spent some a good amount of time looking for it. It was called the An Essay Towards the Real Character in Philosophical Language. But what does it say about the limitations of trying to create this? Because the words in Wilkins' language didn't stand for a concept. It defined the concept. Is that a problem?
Yeah, so you want to say the word for anything, you have to know where it stands in the scheme of things in the universe. So if you want to say the word dog, you have to work down through the hierarchy. It's a type of beast. Okay, that gives you what the first letter of the word is. It's of the oblong-headed kind, and it's terrestrial as opposed to aquatic. Okay, that takes us down into, you know, wolves and jackals and things. Okay, and then so each step of the way, you have to make a decision about where dog is placed with relation to the rest of the beasts. And it's very hard to think this way, much less express yourself this way. So the main problem, and I I you know, my first glance at the project was, wow, this is sort of ridiculous. But wait a second, how do I know that? I'm just going to take it at its word. And so I tried to translate some things into it. And I translated a few sentences into this language that took me days just to find where each concept might be. And it's a testament to Wilkins that I could find everything I needed and I could make a translation, but it was exhausting. And that's the main problem with it. Before you want to say anything in this language, you must know exactly what you mean to say. And very few of us do when we talk.
I'm not sure how to talk about a word we're not supposed to say on the radio, but there's a great section in your book about this, where you essentially deal with the S word, if we could put it that way. You know, that word that means poop. Trying to figure out how you say the S word in Wilkins' language, I guess, told you a lot about the limitations of invented language.
Yeah, you know, I thought it would be somewhere in, you know, organic matter,
right.
But it's under the heading action. It's an action, a motion, of purgation, from the guts downwards. That's basically where it stands in the place of the universe. But who would think that the initial tree branch you should go off of was motion when you're looking for that?
Right. There's a woman named Suzette Hayden Elgin that you write about. This was a linguist working in the 60s and 70s in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And there was this feminist theory at the time that human languages were pretty crummy about expressing the perceptions of women. Mm-hmm. So there were these efforts to create. I guess Elgin wanted to see what a language that you would create that made a better perception of women would be like. And so she writes this novel and she sort of constructs a language. Would you talk a little bit about that? This was a really interesting story.
Yes. The idea was that when you use the language that we have, the language is sort of defined by a particular worldview, and that might not be the worldview you want to express. So she created a language, and it was pretty complex, not just a vocabulary, but a way of marking verbs and a way of structuring sentences that would be framed from a woman's perspective. Now, the idea wasn't that only women should speak it. It was that everyone would speak it, and in doing so, they would have to shift their perspective toward a woman's point of view. But it does have some funny vocabulary, like there's a word for a time that's a holiday, but that's so much work because of all the preparations and cleaning and cooking that you have to do and all these guests and none of them help, that it's actually a burden. So that's one word in the language.
Right.
Why don't we have that summed up in one simple lexical item? It would sort of make it would capture the idea that probably a lot of women have felt over the years very succinctly. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of vocabulary like that. But there's also you also have to mark every statement you make with an ending that says what the intention of your statement is. So this does is prevent someone saying, "Hey, I was just kidding," and it being the burden on you to say to be taking offense. You can always say back to them, "Ah, but you did not mark your verb with the particle for kiddingness."
Right, right.
So it's the burden of the person who said it then, rather than on the person taking it the wrong way.
How does English do in the scheme of things? In terms of obviously, it's incredibly successful as a language. Why do you figure a language like English has worked? I mean, has this process taught you something about how there are flaws within the system, the grammar stuff? Everyone gripes about the spelling stuff and all of those kinds of things, but somehow it's managed to work. How do you figure?
Well, I think it goes to show that it's not the features of the language themselves that make a language desirable to people or even more efficient to people. People say, "Oh, it's because English has a simpler grammar, or English has a more widespread vocabulary in terms of its roots." So, you know, those things probably help a little, but often its success of a language is circumstances and luck, and the way that it spreads for various other reasons having to do with society and communication and the way people communicate. It's not the features of the language itself, the way the verbs are used, the vocabulary, things like that, that make it successful or unsuccessful.
Yeah. When we get back from a break, we'll talk about the current version of people who are trying to create languages, the Conlang community, as it's been called. Erica Okrent is with us. Her book is In the Land of Invented Languages, Adventures in Linguistic Creativity, Madness, and Genius. Today on Video West, we're premiering a short documentary called Building a Language. Trent Pearson of American Fork started inventing languages at 10 years old. His language is called Idrani. It helps him reimagine the world. You can see it at videowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we are talking about constructed language. If you think hard, you can come up with a few. Esperanto is one. Klingon is another. Tolkien, of course, invented a few. There are more than 900 of these over the stretch of 900 years, and probably a lot more than that. And most of them have failed miserably. And there's a reason for that, which we've been talking about. But people keep trying, and it turns out there's a whole community of people who do this. They're called Conlangs, constructed language. And we're talking a little bit about these kinds of languages with Erica Okrent, who's joining us, a linguist, language editor at Mental Floss. Her book is In the Land of Invented Languages, Adventures in Linguistic Creativity, Madness, and Genius. So let's talk about Tolkien, because his name obviously always comes up when you're talking about constructed languages. There's an email we received from Mary who says, I love the idea that Tolkien invented the Elvish language before he wrote The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. And this is something you point out, that Tolkien didn't create his languages for Lord of the Rings, but it was the other way around, which shows that this was an act of creativity for him.
Yeah, it was expressing his personal aesthetic, his personal vision of what he thought a language should look like, what a language that most pleased him would look like, an aesthetic vision that he was trying to match, which makes it very different from the ones we've been talking about up till now had a purpose, a problem to solve. I'm building this language to solve this problem. He did his language building in secret, and he talked about it as the secret vice. And sometimes he would notice someone and think, I think maybe they're doing it too, but we can't talk about it because it's sort of a shameful thing. It has no use to it. If people found out I was doing this, they would say, what's the point? Why are you doing that?
Yeah.
But yeah, he wrote the books to give his languages a place to live, a place where they would make sense.
What do we know about his interest in building languages? I mean, as you say, it really appealed to his personal aesthetic. Mm-hmm. Discovering the Finnish language, though, I think was important in the way he was thinking about all of this.
Yeah, he fell in love with the Finnish when he was as a student. Just the grammar of it. He loved the sound of Welsh as a child, and he wanted to match that somehow. So he picked the sound he liked, the kind of grammar that appealed to him, and put it together, but not in a haphazard way, in a very methodical way. He had charts and tables and even a whole history of derivation that matched up with what we might have for, how English came from the old Germanic roots and whole branching of families. He did that for his languages. So he used stuff in the real world and what we really know about etymology and language change and applied it to his own project so that the language didn't just sound nice. It didn't just match the idea of what, some creatures that he was thinking of would have talked like. It actually had a system to it that was pleasing to him as a system and that a fan can look at and dig. You can really sink your teeth into it. If you want to know about the languages, you will keep discovering connections and logical relationships based on what we know about how languages really evolve and change.
as you said, he called this his secret vice. He was kind of sheepish about letting people know that he was digging into this like that. But that is certainly not the case anymore. Conlangers are very much out of the closet. Let's talk a little bit about the current Conlang community as you started to dig in. How do you describe these people? I mean, you talk about over history, clearly the people who created languages tended to be pretty eccentric types. What characterizes the Conlang community today, if something does?
Well, there's this passion for language that is practiced for its own sake. So I suspect many of the languages inventors of the past had this, but it's so hard to justify to people. Why are you doing this? Why do you make up your own language when you could be, you know, helping revive Cornish or something, or doing, you know, helping endangered languages,
right.
or you know, helping people learn English who need to learn English? There's so many practical things you could be doing with your love of language. Why do this useless thing? This is how people look at it, and that's why people have hidden it. But with the, you know, like with most things, with the internet community possibilities, you can now discover your tribe and the other people who do it, and sort of unashamedly do it for its own sake. So you're creating this language not because you want a Nobel Peace Prize for your invention, or because you want to, you know, make a universal language, but so that other like-minded people will look at it and say, oh, yes, I like the way you did that, just for art appreciation for its own sake.
Yeah.
And I got a chance to go to one of their conferences, one of the early ones, and see this in action, people presenting their languages, people talking about how they worked. And the people there knew an incredible amount about natural languages, because the more exotic and different natural languages you know about, you can sort of pillage them for their unique features and expand on them and be inspired by them in their own language. So conlangers of today are really language lovers. They love natural languages, but they're also artists just doing it for its own sake.
You know, and I have to say, you get a sense that they're really passionate, lovely people. I mean, we've been getting to know a man here in Utah who's invented his own language called Idrani, Trent Pearson. And he doesn't seem to have any, you know, big grand illusions about his particular language, you know, that like it's going to be picked up by the UN and used around the world or anything like that. I mean, for him, it's a fun project, but meaningful too. Mm-hmm. And an important way for him anyway of processing what's going on in his own life, but also it's about love for him, and it's about empathy, which is expressed in this video that we produced that I referenced too. You know, for him, it's about sort of finding and exploring a world the way the world can be. And I'm wondering, are you finding that in some of the conlangers, that it's really about these deeply personal things in their own life?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, people... It is such a personal, we talked about Tolkien's personal aesthetic that he was trying to match it. Your tastes in language is very personal. Some people like a romancy language sounding thing. Some people like a Germanic sounding. Some people like far out syntactic principles that no familiar languages seem to use. And so we all have sort of individual tastes in what we like about language. But you can also, even if you don't share those tastes, can say, you know, with a critical eye, that's a good language, or that's a good way to do that. That's an interesting way to do that. And it's that sort of validation from the community is more important than, you know, someone saying, wow, I really want to speak your language, or I want to, you know, use it for something. I sort of compare it to, you know, some people really love roses, growing roses, and roses are not practical plants. You know, nobody ever says to the guy tending to his rose bushes, you know, why don't you grow food for the poor and do something useful with your time, with your love with your green thumb? Well, the roses are what you're after, just because they're beautiful, and because the better you get at doing it, the more beautiful the roses become, and you can see that over time. And other people who appreciate roses can see that. But people who are don't care about that kind of thing might not. But that doesn't it doesn't matter. You're not after the same kind of practical rewards for doing your project because you're doing it for its own sake.
Yeah. For a while, there was a while there that you thought you would create your own language. You didn't ultimately. Mm-hmm. I guess because you realized how tough this would have been. The kind of energy devoted to something like that would be amazing.
Yeah, I thought it would be, you know, fun sort of gimmick for the book. Like, and then I decided to build my own language,
right,
and
right.
Here's what I did. And I came up with a lot of ideas. I like trying to think of, you know, crazy ideas that no one has tried before, and maybe that could be a language, maybe this could be a language. But I just did not have the will to sit down and work it out. And that's where the work comes out. Sort of like, I can imagine a beautiful painting that I'd like to paint and what it would look like, but I don't actually want to sit there and paint it or mix the colors just so and spend hours sketching it out. You know, that's sort of the difference between kind of thinking an art is cool and actually having the inner drive to do what it takes to create it. And I didn't have that,
yeah.
But I can still appreciate it.
Right. Erica Okrent, author of the book In the Land of Invented Languages, joined us from Chicago Public Media. Erica, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'll mention again the video that we are just posting on Video West today. It is a profile of Trent Pearson. It's called Building a Language. He lives in American Fork, has created his own language called Edrani, which he says helps him imagine the possibilities of the world. Produced by our own Josh Weathers. Go see it at videowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about constructed languages and people over time who have invented their own languages for various reasons. And there are a lot of different reasons for all of this. We had with us earlier the linguist Erica Okrent on the program. Joining us now is Britton Watkins, who is directing a new documentary called Conlanging. He's filming through the end of the year. It's still in the process. Watkins co-wrote and co-produced a science fiction feature called Sen with his husband, Josh Feldman. He also created a language for that project, and we'll talk to him a little bit about that. Britton Watkins is joining us today, along with Josh Feldman. Feldman is editor and director of photography for Conlanging, the documentary that they're creating. They're both joining us from public radio station KRCB in Rohnert Park, California. Britton and Josh, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Britton, let me start with you, because at least if I understand it right, this idea for this project was yours, at least because you yourself have dabbled in this some. Talk to me a little bit about the idea of what you wanted to get at by creating a documentary.
Well, I only discovered the depth and the many different fascinating features of the international Conlanging community about 5 years ago when I came into contact with the group of people who began learning the Na'vi language from Jim Cameron's Avatar, the 2009 film Avatar. And as a person who does research professionally for high-tech firms, I put on my kind of adventurer's cap and researcher's cap and began learning about all the different aspects of this community and this phenomenon about 5 years ago. And I read Erica's book actually almost at the very beginning of my journey with all of this and found a lot of the background I didn't know about interesting. But I just felt like, you know, now's the time that it would be ideal to use the medium of film to tell this story, this broad and fascinating story about people who are still inventing languages for all of their own various personal reasons.
You know, I think the question comes up, who are these people? What are they doing? And you've talked about how there's a lot of kind of misunderstanding, even cruelty, when people talk about communities like this, the Conlang community in this case. Who are these people? How do you describe them now that you've been getting to know them?
Well, I describe them as generally intelligent, inquisitive, and quite talented people who have a very specific interest in language and the possibility of using language as a medium to explore various axes of artistic endeavor. Some people, again, are more fascinated by the purely linguistic side, the theoretical side of language. Others are very much into creating beautiful pieces of poetry, yeah, or they're into designing scripts that look flowing and beautiful or exotic on the page. So there are all kinds of different people who in their everyday lives are, you know, have a past in the U.S. military, or they're linguists themselves. They might be professors in a university, or they might be a 14-year-old who's just trying to figure out what they're going to do for the rest of their life, and they happen to love playing with language.
Josh Feldman, you so you sort of came to this as more of an outsider than Britain, although I think Britain even refers to himself as an outsider in some ways. He's just started in all of this. What do you make of what you're seeing? What are the characteristics of the people you're meeting? I wanted to get your sense of it all.
Yeah, I can definitely consider myself an outsider. I mean, I'm hopeless at language and couldn't learn one if I tried. But I find it really fascinating. And what we're finding is that the people who do this, they absolutely love it. They just want to do it 24 hours a day. They're driven to spend, in some cases, 20, 30 years working on their own artistic language. And they want to devote every second they possibly can to it. I mean, people don't do this because they feel like it's a chore or like, oh, I don't want to work on my language.
Right.
No, they absolutely love it. So there are these people that just have this built-in capacity for language, a love for it, and this is the way they express that.
I wanted to play a few pieces of tape that you shared with us. Some of these may make it into your film. Some of them may not. We're not entirely sure at this point. But I think they reflect different perspectives as to why certain people do this, create their own kinds of languages. Let's start with a man by the name of John Quijada. He's one of these people who has created a language on some level because he's trying to expand the possibilities of language. I mean, from John's point of view, the language that we're all working with now is limited. It doesn't quite express, as he says in this moment, what's going on in his head.
What I really wanted to do was try to create a language that overtly expressed all of these cognitive processes going on in the mind that cognitive neuroscience and cognitive linguistics was beginning to show does occur in our minds, but never makes it out of our mouths in terms of language because of the limitations of human language.
Tell us about John. Britain or Josh?
He's
an interesting guy.
John has been working on his language for decades. He's been playing with language again since he was a child. And Ithquil is an exploration, again, into the theoretical side of language. Mm-hmm. You talked earlier in the program with Erica about languages like Esperanto that had a goal for lots and lots of people to learn them and for them to be used internationally, possibly by everyone. John's language, I think, is more an exploration into, again, other philosophers who might be interested in looking at the possibility of the way tiny little morphemes could be put together to make everyday speech. So his target audience would not be for everyone in the world to learn this language, but for other philosophers to enjoy it.
It's what did you make of Erica talking about how these languages generally tend not to work very well because they're not organic, because one of the beauties of the languages that stick around, like English, is that they're flawed, is that they're organic, is that they don't make sense in some ways, but tend to get at how we try to communicate. What did you guys learn, both of you, I want to hear you on this, about language in its bigger sense by looking at this invented language trend?
I think what we found is that the vast majority of conlangers who are working today they're not interested in having their language be used as this kind of universal language.
Yeah.
We've met one or two that, you know, they romantically would love that idea, but they know it's not really possible, and that's not really what they're trying to do. It's more of either an artistic exercise, an intellectual exercise. I think the question is not for today's conlanger so much like, how do I make my language universal, or what would be the best thing to do? It's more, I'm driven to explore this certain artistic idea or this philosophical idea, and I'm going to take it as far as I possibly can and do something really cool with it.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're doing that for purely personal reasons. They don't even share their languages with other people. The motivation is one of art and fun, frankly, for a lot of people. They just get a great deal of personal enjoyment out of doing it. And in some cases, there's one other friend or two other friends who are interested in their language. In some case, they start a little group on Facebook, and multiple people around the world become interested in a specific language, again, for varying reasons. I mean, there might be a single language, and certain people are fascinated by that language for its linguistic attributes, and other people are fascinated with it because of the constructed script in which it's written and how beautiful that looks. So, there are myriad motivations, and the people come from the widest background of you know, professional and educational situations. That it's just fascinating to us how much variety there is in all of the different people who are engaged in this, and that it's happening across cultures, you know, from Asia all the way over to Europe and down through Africa. So it's all around the world.
You mentioned that just the visual impact of these words, or whatever they, however they describe them. I mean, in that sense, it absolutely is an art form. I mean, a lot of them do the drawings themselves. They're very much about Trent Pearson is one, creates these beautiful images, these beautiful figures. How important is that to the conlanger community? It seems like that's a really critical part of it. And that gets to this idea that I think a lot of them are trying to express, and that is, this is a form of art.
Well, certainly for some people, these constructed scripts, this aspect of the integration of constructed scripts with other tidbits of artwork that they do is very important. But there are other people who are very good conlangers in terms of creating fascinating languages, linguistically fascinating languages, that have absolutely no graphic design skill whatsoever. So they're in it for a very different thing. I think it's easy for lay people who don't conlang themselves, who don't create languages themselves, to most easily appreciate constructed scripts and these, you know, beautiful illuminated manuscripts. Trent is very good at making those, for example. It's easy to appreciate those from a lay perspective. But again, if one is a conlanger and understands linguistic science, if you will, a lot of the languages which are written completely in the Roman alphabet, or even only in the International Phonetic Alphabet, are completely beautiful for different reasons.
Yeah.
Maybe not visual reasons, but other more intangible reasons to understand if you're not a language creator yourself.
I want to play another little piece of tape here. This is Aaron Simon. Britton or Josh, would you tell us about Aaron first? Because I thought this was a lovely moment that you shared with us.
Aaron is a really interesting person we found because he's not trained. Some of the people we find who are conlangers, they have a PhD in linguistics and they focused on that for education. He doesn't actually know that much about linguistics. He's picked some stuff up on the way, but he has never had any formal training in it. And yet he has created this amazing, beautiful language, in part for very personal reasons. He had a family situation when he was growing up where he wanted to keep private notes and he was not able to because his stuff could get read by his parents if it was written in a language that's translatable or that's readable. So he came up with his own language, and he is one of the interesting people we found for that reason. We found other people who start with ciphers or secret languages, and that's their focus, and then that turns into a full-fledged conlang later.
Here's Aaron Simon.
I think something important that Sandek has brought to me is a way to think of myself in a positive light. the society that we live in isn't very accepting necessarily of trans people, and so I had to find a word for myself that didn't have a negative connotation to it. And in Sanic, we don't call trans people trans, we call them tahle. And that means the changing people, people of change. And it doesn't have a negative connotation at all. It doesn't necessarily have any. You make it what it is by living. Sanic is a part of me. It's been a safe space. It's been a place where I can express myself and not have to worry about other people necessarily intruding on thoughts that I wouldn't want to share.
I think that's a good segue to talk a little bit more about Trent Pearson, who, as I said, we've met, you've talked to. He's going to be featured in your film. A lot for Trent is a little bit like Aaron Simon in the sense that he's working out some personal questions, very private things, reflections of society that may not be up to quite to snuff. I mean, his ideas of empathy and love and what the world could be, that's part of how he's constructing his language. Talk a little bit about Trent Pearson, if you would.
Well, I met Trent through the international community of people who conlang online a few years ago, and we come from very different social human backgrounds, but we connected very quickly as human beings with each other online. And I think Trent is a great example of someone who does his language, who does Idrani, for really very personal reasons. And it's a part of his exploration of what it means to be alive, to have Idrani. You know, he can play around with concepts and ideas of how he wishes the world worked. And he turns those ideas into actual artifacts, too, the most beautiful pieces of art you can imagine. I mean, from my perspective, they belong in galleries and museums, mm-hmm. and they focus around the heart of his approach to conlanging, which is Idrani and the way it can be visually expressed to make more beauty in the world.
I was interested in, and I just got a hint of it in a piece that you've put together, trying to give potential funders of the film a sense of what you're looking at. And there was this moment where a couple is, quote unquote, speaking a gripping language. Could you tell me a little bit more about that? I'm not sure how much you're going to feature that in the film, but I was really intrigued by that.
Oh, well, we definitely plan to show it because it's a great example of how conlanging delves into alternate channels of communication. Not everything is based on the tongue. But yeah, Alex and Cy have been a couple for many years, and they have a fascinating language that has a very interesting grammar and vocabulary that's based on two people holding hands and the placement of the fingers. And the way that you press and squeeze different joints and knuckles here and there is the language. Words are composed of this physical contact. And that might sound pretty unusual, but there are also people now investigating languages and how constructed language can help with communication between people who are both blind and deaf. And that's a perfect example that you can do that through holding hands, or you could do that from placing your hand on someone's back, for example, and signing on a different part of their body. So there are all kinds of alternate things that are full, valid human communication that don't involve the tongue or the ears or necessarily even the eyes. So constructed languages delve into all different kinds of spheres, and all different kinds of people do that for different reasons. Again, some very personal, some for broader, more humanitarian objectives.
Let me play one more piece of tape. This is a man by the name of Stephen Travis, who's Josh, will you set this up for us? What is he? What I'm interested in is what he gets at is this idea that these languages take people places. You want to say something about Stephen?
Stephen's one of those people, like Trent, that when we went into their studio and saw this body of work they had created over decades, we were blown away. And we really can't wait to show people in the final film how amazing these creations these people have done. And his language is fascinating because there are 8,000 glyphs. So if you think about Chinese, you know, there's 2,000 or 3,000 that are normally used. He's somehow, over the years, created 8,000 different glyphs, and he expresses them in these pieces of art that, in his mind, take him to this imaginary place that he would want to go. Some people, maybe their family is poor. They can't travel a lot. And so this is a way of imagining a place that they want to go, and that's how he's described his language.
When I, as a child, I was making up languages, I felt like the fact of making a language made me feel like I was transported to a very faraway land. And that still persists even to this day, even though I've been fortunate to travel. I'm always looking out for that other destination that is where I would have also wanted to go as a child.
Is that a theme, do you think? I mean, there are all kinds of different reasons. We've already talked about that. But is this one theme that came up for you too? People who said that, not that, and I have to say, I asked Trent in a conversation with him, Trent Pearson, about whether this was an escape. And he says it's not an escape. It's not that people want to pretend the world doesn't exist and they want to go off to another place, but it does give them another sense of, I don't know, of mystery, of going to kind of a really foreign place. Is that what you found?
Yeah, I think I'm clearly in what we're finding, there's a difference in a sense of escape versus exploration. Yeah. I think this is more something of exploration. And you see that and you hear that from Trent, you hear it from Stephen. We find also in the fact that now, you know, Hollywood productions and fancy television productions are investing in having fully fleshed out constructed languages in the rich tapestry of their production. It gives a better sense of authenticity, a better sense of kind of an original experience in that entertainment aspect mm-hmm. of it. But you could be doing that, again, just in your own notebooks and on your own papers or on your own website for your own sense of authenticity and your exploration of ideas. Yeah. It doesn't necessarily have to be backed up by multi-million-dollar budgets.
It's Britton Watkins, co-directed along with Josh Feldman, the documentary Conlanging. At least they're in the process of creating that film. And gentlemen, I wish you luck. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
Today in Video West, premiering Building a Language, Trent Pearson, who we've been talking about from American Fork, has created his own language called Idrani. And you can see him talking about that on videowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program directed by Tim Slover. Video West produced by Josh Weathers. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.